So we'll talk about an approach which takes the ideas of IDS CFT in a somewhat straightforward and pragmatic way. One simple way to understand the motivation of this work is to think of the solution that it is reasonable to expect that the solution to QCD, if it will be eventually found, will most likely will be first done in the limit of large NC, because we already know some features of the large NC. And the ones which I would like to point out is that the resonances are very narrow in this limit. And that suggests that the effective theory, if such theory could be built, in terms of the resonances, will be weakly coupled. So one can ask a question, what form does this effective theory have? What can we say about it? And the string theory explicit examples suggest that this theory has a fifth dimension to it. So they describe a four-dimensional theory through a certain holographic correspondence. And the approach which we would like to take is you can look at it as an alternative or complementary to the approach of from the string theory, where we begin from a theory where we know for almost certain that such correspondence is exact, and even we can use it to calculate some quantities and try to deform such a theory in order to find on a string theory, the theory which is still well-defined and perhaps useful, which maps onto QCD. The approach which I will be describing now is opposite to that. It's a, in a way, bottom-up approach where we start from QCD and assume that such theory does exist. And we're trying to use the holographic correspondence backwards to deduce the properties of such five-dimensional theory. And I will be more concrete later. So I will summarize the result of this preprint, which is in blue. I also want to point out that practically the same model has been suggested almost simultaneously by two other authors, but I will not, there are slight differences, but the basic ideas are the same. The plan of this talk is that it will roughly consist of two main parts. In the first part, I will try to lay down the building blocks for this approach, which will require me to explain some of the not all, but some of the features of IDS CFT correspondence, which I will use in order to build this simple model, which I will describe in the second part. And I will discuss how, in this system, simple model, the description of such properties which we already know in QCD, such as chiral symmetry breaking and quark hadron duality, operator products expansion, map onto the holographic dual of this theory. So the holographic correspondence, or correspondence between the theory, five-dimensional theory in IDS space, and the conformal field theory, I will just briefly remind you. In our case, what we were thinking about is that we begin with the theory, which is basically formulated as a quantum field theory in four dimensions. It has a field, for example, quarks and gluons, and it's characterized by the action. So it's a well-defined, it's a defined theory, right? Now, call the solution, or the quantities of the theory which we are interested in, are the correlation functions, which can be obtained using the generating functional, which we get by introducing a source for the operator, the correlation function of which we want to calculate. So I'm following the same notation as Son did in his talk, and it's a common notation in the holographic approaches. And for simplicity or concreteness, I will talk about the following metric, which looks like it contains a piece which is essentially flat, like a four-dimensional Minkowski metric, but it has a warp factor. There is a fifth dimension, and there is a kind of scale factor, which it depends only on this fifth dimension z. One interesting property which will be important for us for the QCD applications is, in particular, and is that this metric is obviously scale invariant. Also, what we will be discussing is a slice, a finite slice of this metric, which begins at the boundary, which is at z equals 0 or a small epsilon, which can be used in certain cases as a simple regularization. This boundary will be called ultraviolet boundary, hence it's in blue. So it's a four-dimensional space where x1, x2, and x3, and x4 are just four-dimensional coordinates. The other end is at some value or finite value of z, which will sometimes could be called infrared boundary. So the correspondence is between the generating functional for the four-dimensional theory, which is a function of the sources for the or the source for the operator O, and the exponent of the effective action. Essentially, on the right hand, in the five-dimensional theory, what we calculate is a functional of the values of the field, which is by definition the effective action. But the values of the field on the boundary, on this ultraviolet boundary. So the function phi of x naught, I'm sorry, phi, it should be phi naught of x, right? Phi naught of x plays a dual role. In a four-dimensional theory, it's a source for the operator, and in a five-dimensional theory, it's a boundary value of the field, which we have to introduce for each operator. So let me illustrate this on a concrete example. Let us consider operator O, which is a conserved current. So in QCD, it would be operator like this. So it's an isospin vector, isospin current. The source for this operator is a vector potential. I will call it V mu, and index 0 is the same index 0. Just reminds us that it's in a five-dimensional theory. It's the value of the field on the boundary. So the source will appear in the four-dimensional partition function in the following way, or generating functional in the following way, multiplying the current. Yes. Yes, it's the current, the integral of density of which counts the isospin, or the third component of which counts isospin. And the correlator which we'll look at, again, in this example, will be just a two-current correlator. It's a very well-known quantity in QCD. It is easy to calculate perturbatively, and we know that it is proportional to logarithm Q squared. The fact that it's proportional to logarithm of Q squared is a simple consequence of the scale invariance of QCD in the outer violet. It's just it's simple consequences. So what five-dimensional action should we take? So we need to take this source field and extend it into the bulk and to write the effective action for this five-dimensional field, which is a vector field. So the natural choice would be and I will advocate it later, let us choose for now the simple gauge invariant action. Right. So this is a field strength for this field potential, vector potential. G5 is a coupling. There's only one parameter in this section, which is it's fixed. Yes, it will be. I will relate it to G5. This is one interesting result which I'm leading to. So in the five-dimensional theory, it's just some coefficient like f pi in effective Lagrangian for pions. So it's a coefficient which we will later match to some QCD parameter if we are able to calculate, do the calculation on both sides. So what calculations should we do? We should minimize this action. Let us work in the again in the tree level. We should minimize this action with respect to the function v, which enters through here. Calculate the action at that value of v, keeping v equal v0 at the boundary, right? Then the action will depend, will be a functional of v0, the value of the field on the boundary, and the second derivative of this function will give us the current. So what does it give us? So in order to find the solution, since we are only interested in a two-point correlator, it's sufficient to keep only quadratic terms in the action, which means we simply need to solve Lagrangian equations, which are in this case linear. Because of the gauge invariance, we can choose the gauge, and the simplest choice, which simplifies the calculation, is the axial gauge where the fifth component is set to zero. This linear equation is just an ordinary differential equation for this function. And what we are looking at is a solution which satisfies the boundary condition, which is the value of V0 with respect to which we want to calculate the second derivative. So as we vary V0, this equation determines the solution. Again, because the equation of because the action is quadratic, if we integrate by parts, we will see that the bulk contribution to the action vanishes by equation of motion, and the only contribution comes from the boundary. And again, because the equation is linear, we can just solve it for a boundary condition fixed to some value, let's say 1, and then all the other solutions will be just multiples of that solution. So following this calculation, we find the value of the polarization operator, or this scalar function which characterizes the strength of the two-particle two-current correlator. And it's related to the derivative, to the derivative of the function v, or rather second derivative, at the boundary. This function which satisfies this equation normalized to value 1. So it's a very simple relationship between the solution to this equation and the... this equation is simple enough that we can obtain the solution in a closed form. And we can now take the limit z goes to 0, and we find expected logarithmic behavior in Q squared. What is interesting that if now we want to match this result to QCD, we obtain a relationship between the coupling in the five-dimensional effective theory, which and the number of colors in QCD. An interesting relationship is that large NC corresponds to small coupling, exactly as we would expect in the large NC in the effective theory describing resonances in large NC QCD. So there are a couple of other notes one also should make. The correlator, which is calculated like this, is if we also took care of the Lorentz components, we would find that it's also transverse. And it's very easy to see that it's a simple consequence of the fact that the effective action doesn't depend on the boundary value of the longitudinal component of the field V0. So derivative with respect to this component gives zero. But the derivative, since the longitudinal component of V0 is a source for the longitudinal component of the current, it means that the insertion of the longitudinal component of the current into any correlator will give zero, which is just the condition that the current is conserved. Therefore, we can make a relationship between the conservation of the current and the gauge invariance of the effective five-dimensional action. As I already said, one can also observe that in five-dimensional theory, the log q squared can be also traced to the scale invariance of the metric which we used in this case. And all this and can be summarized in a dictionary of translation between the four-dimensional theory and the five-dimensional effective or holographic description of it. So the generating function in terms of the sources for the four-dimensional theory is simply equal to the effective theory in terms of the boundary values of the fields dual to each operator. The operator corresponds to, is represented by the five-dimensional field. The scale invariance of the four-dimensional theory translates into scale invariance, obviously, in the five-dimensional theory, conservation of currents, the gauge invariance. Number of degrees of freedom in four-dimensional theory relates to the strength of the coupling in five-dimensional theory. One can also, looking at the solution, observe that this variable z has a relationship to the scale, to the moment or the energy scale in the five-dimensional. Just looking at the solution, one can see that the response, the theory to perturbations at large q would correspond to the behavior of the five-dimensional theory at small z. And one other relationship, which will be I will discuss on the next transparency, which Son already mentioned, which will be part of the building blocks of this model, is the relationship between the dimension of the operator and the mass of the field, which represents this operator in the five-dimensional theory. So let us consider, as a simple example, some scalar operator, which should be therefore represented in five-dimensional effective theory by a five-dimensional scalar field. And the equation, well, the Lagrangian for the five-dimensional effective field, let us consider just a free Lagrangian, contains a kinetic term and a mass term. So M5, which is this number is dimensional. So if you count the dimensions, this parameter is just a dimensionless number. One can see that by solving the, it's easy to write and solve the Lagrange-Euler equations for the equation of motions for this Lagrangian. And one can find that for a very small z, the dependence on q, if q is not large enough, becomes less important. And the solution can be just found by substituting a power law solution into the equations with a power which is determined by just a simple equation. So the power with which the solution of this equation approaches the boundary is related to the to the coefficient of the mass term. So if the mass of this scale is zero, then we can easily satisfy the boundary condition that phi goes to some constant, which is the value of the source for the operator to which phi is the dual field. However, if mass is not zero, then we cannot do this. Instead, what we should do is multiply, equate to phi zero the coefficient of the power. Otherwise, we won't be able to satisfy the boundary condition. So, in other words, phi divided by z to the delta phi should go to a constant. And now just a simple counting of dimension shows the relationship between the mass and the I will denote the dimensions by of a quantity by the square brackets. It's easy to see from this Lagrangian the dimension of the scalar field must be zero. The dimension of the from here it follows the dimension of the source must be delta phi. Just by looking at this relationship, this is zero. If the dimension of the each coordinate is minus one, so this is delta phi. So this must be also delta phi. And because in the way that the source and the field enters in the four-dimensional Lagrangian, the dimension of the source and plus dimension of the field must be equal to four. So that gives us the relationship between five-dimensional mass and the scaling dimension of operator in a four-dimensional theory. And a simple example, if we consider, for example, the operator which generates the rotations, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, which has dimension 4, substituting 4 here gives us 0. So that should be described by the massless scalar field, the dilaton. Psi bar psi has dimension 3. Substituting here, we get minus 3. For the currents, the relationship is somewhat different, but one can see that if we repeat this, we'll find that for the current with dimension 3, substituting 3 here, we'll get 0. So the masslessness, the fact that we describe the current by represent the current by a five-dimensional gauge field with zero mass is related to the fact that the current has dimension 3. And the fact that the gauge invariant protects the mass has a correspondence to the fact that the conservation of current preserves the dimension of the operator. Yes, but I can then rescale and redefine the field phi. So, maybe, but let me define the field phi in such a way that its kinetic term is canonically normalized. Then for this field, but then, right. Now, related to that, and also important building block of our model is the representation of the chiral symmetry breaking in the holographic correspondence. Let us again consider, for simplicity, the same scalar field. So we are looking at the representation of a theory which we are interested in the correlation function of some scalar operator. Then, as we already discussed, the solution which we are looking for must satisfy the boundary condition, which depends on what is the five-dimensional mass or the dimension of the field in this way. So it should approach the boundary value phi zero if we rescale by the appropriate power of z. Of course, it's a second order differential equation, so it has two solutions. And it's easy to see that that equation which we wrote has indeed is a quadratic equation for delta. It has two solutions with a simple relationship between the powers of the two solutions. They have to sum up to four. And so this is the general solution, where the coefficient of this must be determined by, of the second solution, will be determined by the boundary condition at another boundary, infrared boundary condition. Now let us calculate, substitute this action, this into this action, solution to the action, and calculate the variational derivative with respect to, if we vary the source, how much the action will vary. And the calculation which has to be done carefully, and perhaps the simplest exposition of this calculation can be found in Klebanov and Witten paper, gives a result which is easy to understand intuitively, that is proportional, that the variation is proportional to the variation of the boundary condition with a coefficient of proportionality, which is the value of this coefficient of the second solution A. Now, if we match this to the variation of the generating functional with respect to the source, we know that the coefficient of proportionality of this in this variation is the expectation value of the operator. And therefore, the coefficient of this term is related up to a numerical constant dependent on the dimension of the operator to the expectation value of the operator. And therefore, spontaneous symmetry breaking means in five-dimensional theory that if we take the limit of the source going to zero, the solution, the function, well, the A should go to a non-zero constant. Now, with these building blocks, it should be easy to understand the model which we want to look at. So what we want to, well, obviously, since QCD has infinitely many operators, the theory which would account for all correlation functions in QCD must have infinitely many fields. However, it's not unnatural or not unreasonable to expect that if we are only interested in certain correlation functions, for example, the correlation functions of the operators which pertain to the chiral symmetry breaking, which are the currents, the left and the right chiral currents, and the order parameter, which is psi bar psi, and if we're only looking at the correlation function of these operators, we can try to write down the effective theory only in terms of those operators. Therefore, or in terms of the fields, which are extension in the five-dimensional bulk of the sources for these operators, right? So that means, so let us limit ourselves to those three types of three operators. So we have two currents. Each of them corresponds to a gauge field in five-dimensional bulk. And we have, it's a matrix because quark in the isospin space, these are isospin indices alpha and beta. But it's a scalar from a Lorentz point of view, and it should be represented by a scalar field, which is also a matrix in the isospin case. Now, since these are conserved currents, the action for in the five-dimensional action must be gauge invariant. So that's very easy to write this term with effective with a coupling G5. And for the scalar field, we should just simply write again the term must respect the gauge invariance, which corresponds to the chiral SU2 cross SU2. Symmetry, and the mass term, which corresponds to the dimension of the operator to which x is dual, which is 3, because it's q bar q. I can rescale it. Of course, in order to be able to calculate anything in this theory, we have to specify the infrared boundary conditions. In a realistic theory, we would expect that the metric will be continuously modified in the infrared. We actually don't know what the metric is. So what we are trying to do is to make a very crude representation of the confinement, which is basically the scale at which we introduce a scale in a five-dimensional theory, which cut off this ADS slice. Therefore, we introduce in the otherwise scale invariant theory an explicit violation of the scale invariance, which confinement is, right? So the only thing which is we seem to be able to constrain is one could probably argue that the reasonable boundary condition at the slice must be gauge invariant, and that's what we impose. So we impose the conditions which are gauge invariants on this field. So this is the condition on the vector fields, and this is the condition on the scalar field. So in the linear approximation, this will be just Neumann boundary conditions. Now the chiral symmetry breaking is represented by the fact that if we solve the equation for this field X with a boundary condition that it approaches Z times M, since M is a source for psi by psi, right? So M plays the role of phi naught for this operator, right? X is a solution. And the second solution has a coefficient which should be proportional to the chiral condensate, or the vacuum expectation value of the Q bar Q, right? This is the M, which is the matrix, which is diagonal with matrix elements MU, MD, and MS. In this theory, I'm not sure we can discuss the scale because in order to do this, we would have to introduce the anomalous dimension also for the field X, which we do not. So we neglect the running of the at this level. It could be improved upon. Not practically, but I think theoretically one can understand how to do that. So I don't think this is a fundamental limitation. I think of this as a simplifying assumption for this particular model. What I want to simply do is to construct the model which is simple enough that we can obtain from it a meaningful phenomenological prediction and see how well they compare to experimental values. And the reason that I want to discuss it here is that the agreement is remarkably good. So which should yes. 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 But let me discuss here what are the parameters in this model. Yes. The chiral symmetry breaking is. It can be made somewhat dynamical by requiring that the boundary condition on X and the value of sigma, which is the expectation value of the chiral condensate, is the order parameter for the chiral symmetry breaking, is determined by the boundary condition in the infrared, as I discussed. No, from this linear boundary condition, you cannot, in order to one can, in principle, make this value of sigma quasi-dynamical or look dynamical by imposing nonlinear boundary condition in the infrared. Then one could come up with a solution which will be which will give non-zero value of sigma, because yes, but we do not want to discuss the boundary condition. Instead, we use this sigma as a parameter. We assume that that it is given, right? And this will be additional parameter in the model. As I discussed here, the model which we have has a small number of parameters by as a consequence of the simplifications that we made. But it's still one parameter more than in QCD. In QCD, we have a single parameter, which is QCD scale, which determines both the scale of the chiral symmetry breaking order parameter and the confinement scale, right, or the mass of the raw meson. While in this case, we have to introduce two separate parameters. Yes, but it has number of colors. So G5 is a number of colors. So this matching is very simple. MQ is MQ, and G5 is a number of colors. So we have to. Excuse me? Yes. Yeah. So we can go to chiral limit. We can go to chiral limit. So let us see another property known from QCD, how it is represented in this five-dimensional theory. Returning back to the equation which we needed to solve in this example of the current in order to calculate the two current correlator, let us look instead of the solution which satisfies the condition V equals 1 at the boundary. Let us look at other set of the solutions, which so-called normalizable modes, which satisfy the condition that they go to 0 sufficiently fast at the boundary. It's a second order differential equation. So there are two sets of the solutions. So these are the condition on the solution. It is a simple mathematical identity which allows us to express the solution which enters here as a linear combination of the other set of the, in the same way as we can Fourier expand cosine function in terms of sine functions, which are another set of the solutions to the harmonic equation. The only difference is that, the main difference is that such normalizable solutions exist only for certain values of Q, unlike the solution which we considered before, which existed for any Q. The solution which satisfies such boundary condition and normalization condition exists only for certain values of Q, from 0 to Zm, or from epsilon to Zm, from epsilon to Zm. Yeah. Yeah. Normalizable in the sense of this integral. So if I took this, if I set. Yes, that's true. I'm just trying to use the terminology which already exists. So you don't have to use it. But if you want to understand it. So there are two solutions to this equation. One behaves like, one behaves like a constant, another behaves like z to the 4, right, because of the dimension, right? So the one which is a constant is the one for which this integral would not be normalizable. And the one which you are looking at is the one which decays sufficiently fast at the boundary, that integral is fine. Yeah, of course, I can choose a different. This Neumann condition is a consequence of the conditions which I imposed in the very beginning, which are gauge invariant conditions. But in principle, these conditions follow from. No. I'm sorry. Yes. If you fix, I think what I want to say is that the boundary condition is uniquely determined by these two. This solution is uniquely determined by these two conditions. The normalization condition is only needed because this equation is linear. So the equation is not uniquely defined, right? It's defined up to a constant. This constant is fixed by this normalization integral. That's all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe I don't want to use the terminology of normalizability after all, if it causes more problems. Then I thought it would make it easier to recognize for those people who use this terminology. Maybe I'm not introducing it properly. I'm sorry about that. So the solution which we are looking at is the other solution, right, which behaves, which goes to zero. And unlike the solution which we considered before, which we called V, it exists only at a particular value, at a set of values of Q squared. In order to understand what the meaning of these values is, one should express V in terms of the as an expansion in terms of the solutions psi, and one finds that the values of Q at which the solution exists correspond to the poles in the two current correlator, which means that these values are the masses of the vector mesons, which can be created by the operator of the isospin vector current acting on the vacuum. And consequently, the decay constant of the meson is related to the derivatives of these solutions at epsilon. I'm sorry, I said z to the fourth. It's z squared, because it's a vector current. The sum of the is shifted. So the solutions behave like z squared. So this is a finite number for each of them. And this when epsilon goes to zero. And one can recognize by comparing the result in terms of the log to result in terms of the sum of the poles, one can recognize the relationship similar to the QCD sum rules. The behavior of the correlator, the logarithmic behavior of the correlator in the regime where Q squared is Euclidean is represented by the sum of the poles in the regime located at the time-like values of Q squared. Yes. Yeah. And that the reason that I brought up this result, which is that although is that this result would be true even if we perturbed or deformed the background. The relationship between this function and the other solutions remains intact even if the background is different. The values of Q, M rho will change. The values, the functional forms and these coefficients will also change. But the sum rule will still hold. No, they are not. These are the proportional to the roots of the Bessel functions. Yeah. So it will because these solutions are in fact well, they have zeros where the Bessel function is zero, has zero. Now, in order to understand the chiral symmetry breaking, let me look at a little more ambitious problem. I will look at the mass of the pion close to the chiral limit. That is, I will try to derive the Gell-Monoux-Rainer relationship, which relates the mass of the pion to the mass of the quark. In order to do this, I would have to look at the sector of this theory, which involves the axial current, which is left minus right, which involves the phase of the pion or of the field x, which I will call pi, so there are three field equations which are coupled to each other. Well, the field equation which I obtained for the transverse component of the axial vector is decoupled. Just simply by Lorentz symmetry, it cannot couple to the pseudoscalar. And this equation is very similar to the equations for the vector field, except for this term, which is due to the chiral symmetry breaking. V, I guess I didn't write the expression for V. I have to. It is there? Oh, yeah. V is here, right. So V is non-zero when the chiral symmetry is broken, either explicitly or more spontaneously. And these two terms, these two equations, which are the variational spherical longitudinal component and the EZ component of the field, which mix phi, which is longitudinal component of the field, and the phase of the x. So this field will describe to us the A1 meson, the axial vector mesons. The linear combination of phi and pi fields will describe us, or the normalizable modes of these equations will describe to us the tower of pi prime, which begins from the pi meson, right? Axial Iser vectors, axial scale Iser vectors. So again, following the same calculation for the polarization for the two current correlator, in QCD, we know that because of the presence of the pion, this correlator must have a pole at Q squared equals zero in the chiral limit, and the coefficient of the pole is what where we can extract the value of the constant f pi, and therefore f pi can be now related to the derivative of this solution similar to that one for that equation at the boundary. Now, it's easy to see that if we just set mq to 0, then, and q to 0, then this equation for phi and this equation to a look very similar. And it means that, in practice, that if we substitute this at q equals 0, into this system of equation, so phi is a minus 1 and pi is minus 1, then they will trivially solve this system of equation. However, what we want is the, yes? It means mq equals to 0.
No.
Yeah. It's small relative to Zm, to 1 over Zm. This is the scale. Well, just purely mathematically, if you just set q equals to 0, then you will find that this is just at q equals to 0, this is a solution. So we can calculate the, so in order to find the mass of the pion, we need to find the solution, the normalizable mode, right, of this equation, which involves both phi and pi, which satisfies the boundary condition here, and solves this equation. We can solve this equation to leading order in m pi by substituting the solution for m pi equals 0, which is mq equals 0, right? And integrating this equation. So by integrating this equation, we find this expression for the field pi as an integral this is essentially phi here. Now this integral can be the integrand of this integral can be split in two parts. One which is very rapidly converging, which on its own will give very rapid rapid convergence to the integral. It looks like this. And its support is located at a very small value of z, which goes to 0 when mq goes to 0. So this part of the integral is just a very sharp peak, which shifts to towards the boundary as we approach the chiral limit. While this part, according to this equation, goes to a constant. This is how it looks like. So we can take this out, replace it by the constant, which is f pi, and then this integral can be easily calculated. And the result is 1 over 2 mq sigma. And in order for this to be a solution for sufficiently large, for large z, bigger than this value, we have to equate this to minus 1. Then it will solve the equations. The reason that I'm discussing in this way, I want to emphasize that the equation which I will derive is also robust towards towards continuous deformations of the metric. So, then the Gell-Mann-Oakes-Renner relationship doesn't hold. Then I cannot derive it analytically, but I know how it begins. The mass of the point begins like square root of mq. Asymptotically, I'm not sure that answer to the I don't know the answer to this question, but I'm not sure the answer to this question has much physical significance. Because the basic this equation is a simple consequence of the chiral symmetry. The only thing which we want to see here is that it is indeed robust, as the consequences of the chiral symmetry should be, regardless of what the background we choose. Yes? Yes. 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 I just want to verify that indeed, in a sense, you can think of trying to solve the hydrogen atom using pass integral formalism. It's not the best way to do it, but it doesn't mean that the pass integral formalism is a useless formalism. Let me. Just since I don't have much time, I will just mention that this result is robust, and one can check in particular that the Gell-Mann-Oakes relationship holds even if the dimension of the operator x, or q bar q, is not equal to 3. If we restore this dimension as delta sigma, which we chose to be 3, and redo this integral, we find, as a result, the same relationship if we take into account the fact that sigma is related to the expectation value of the q bar q by this coefficient, which is the difference of the, which depends on the dimension of the operator. I just plotted numerically obtained solutions to these equations, the normalizable modes. So they all vanish at the boundary. The boundary is now on the left. They satisfy the Neumann boundary condition on the right. one can see that the rho wave function is this, the most smoothly varying wave function. The rho prime is the one which has the one node, and so on. The as already mentioned by Son, the couplings, trilinear couplings in the theory can be also easily calculated, and they are represented by overlap integrals between this wave function. So this is more precise relationship for the coupling 0 pi pi, which has a good experimental for which there is experimental determination. So now I described how this model is built, now let us see how it numerically compares with the experiment. So the way what we do here is, I remind you, the model has four parameters: G5, ZM, sigma, and MQ. QCD so has to provide four inputs to determine these parameters. We choose those inputs and see M rho, which is this is just a zero of the Bessel function. It fixes M rho fixes ZM, and F pi and M pi fixes sigma and MQ. So striking out NC from this table, we're only left with three values which are marked with stars, which are I don't know the number, although it wouldn't be very difficult to calculate, I think. I can tell you this afternoon. It wouldn't be very difficult. These are the numbers except for M rho prime, which we list in the paper. But perhaps I'm going on the next transparency. Of course, the validity of this simple model should be questioned once we go higher in the energy or the mass scale, because there are excitations which are not described by this model. For example, particles with spin 2. Okay. Now I want to touch upon the relationship between this model and the model which we discussed with Son earlier, which is the open MOOS, which is can be considered. The open MOOS can be considered as a generalization of this hierarchy of series, which I represent the series by this diagrams. Each blob representing a gauge field, and each link representing a sigma model type matrix field. So a model with a single link is just a nonlinear sigma model, which describes the triplet of pions. One extra gauge field with a bifundamental, it describes pi and rho, and the generalization to this is what terminologically, following the existing terminology, should be called open MOOS. One can recognize in it a discretization of a five-dimensional gauge theory, in which the four dimensions are not discretized, and they're just represented by the gauge fields, and the fifth dimension is discretized, and sigma plays the role of the link variable for the gauge field, A5. I would have to spend more time to explain this. I can explain maybe rho very quickly by saying that, yeah. row. A1 is a simple generalization for this. In order to describe two vector mesons, you need to introduce two gauge potential fields, right? A1 and A2. So these are represented by two. Of course, pi. Well, in order to make them massive, I also need to introduce additional scalar degrees of freedom. Could be, but that would not be the. It would be a noose.
But why do you want to make a noose?
Because it's a simple generalization of the idea, which seemed to have a phenomenological success. The theory with just a simple link already has a reasonable phenomenology. One of the consequences of the moves, the way that we connect it, perhaps the strongest one, is that the Rho meson dominance in the pi and 4 factor appears as a direct consequence of this structure. If you try to... No, from the second line, there is extra parameter which you have to adjust to provide the Rho meson dominance. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. General. What I'm talking about is a generalized Rho vector meson dominance, because in principle the effective theory cannot forbid a contact term in the right. It's QCD which says it cannot exist, right? But the effective theory allows a contact term. So this theory will, for generic values of the parameters, have a contact term in the pi. The term in the expansion of the pi n form factor, which is not a pole, right? Which is not just a contribution which can be described by a diagram like this. Photon transforms into Rho meson or Rho prime, and then couples to pi. In principle, that model would have a diagram like this, with a point like form factor, right? In order to forbid it, you have to choose particular values of parameter. Here it happens automatically. That's one of the interesting consequences. There are others, but I would have to finish the talk. I have a boundary condition. Yes. So what all I wanted to say is that you can view if you discretize the theory which we have just discussed, you can view it as a moose being folded in half, and the field X is a bifundamental field which lives on this links. Now I don't have time to discuss the operator product expansion. And I will just summarize. Instead of the summary, I just want to tell you what problems one can think about which could extend this model. One is, of course, it shouldn't be, it appears rather easy to extend this model to describe the scalar globals. For that, we need to introduce the scale. And in fact, some calculations which are similar to what this model would lead to have been already done. Of course, one can extend the phenomenology to include the strange mesons. One can include the terms which describe the interaction, the meson interaction due to the Vesuminovitantom or the anomaly, the chiral anomaly, which in the five-dimensional language becomes even more natural, because as you know, Vesumina term has such a property. Another interesting extension, obviously, would be to include fermions or baryons. A model of a type like this has been already also discussed in the literature, and the natural question to ask then, is there something interesting we can learn about finite density for using such an effective approach? And as I already mentioned, the background which we chose is simple in a sense that it's totally provides a totally scale invariant theory. We know that scaling invariance is logarithmically violated in QCD. Presumably, it shouldn't be difficult to modify the theory to include the to modify the background to include the logarithmic violations of scaling if one wants to go into that direction. Thank you. Here or here? No. Was it in the very beginning? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the previous one. Yeah, so the term which would normalize this log, if that's what you are asking. Yeah. The term which would normalize this log will not depend on Q, it would be a constant. And therefore, in the coordinate space, it's just a delta function. So it's a contact term. If we are looking at the behavior of the correlate as a function of the distance, we should look only on the terms which depend non-trivially on Q. So of course, there is a constant here. In fact, this constant is infinite, because of the, it has to be removed. Well, the scale of the most directly related parameter in this model to lambda QCD is ZM, 1 over ZM. It just provides the scale. Maybe I can phrase it in this way. I can relate lambda QCD to the mass of the raw meson. Right? So if I scale lambda QCD, the raw mass of the raw meson should be proportional to lambda QCD. Right? So the fact that 1 over ZM is simply proportional to the to M rho tells you that ZM is related to lambda QCD. So if in QCD I would calculate M rho and express it in terms of lambda QCD, there would be some other coefficient here times lambda QCD. I can use this relationship to match the value of ZM to the value of lambda QCD. They're just proportional. Yeah, yeah. It's a parameter which characterizes the scale of the breaking of the scale invariance, right? So, right, in four-dimensional theory, it's lambda QCD, dimensional transmutation, but in five-dimensional theory, we introduce a hard wall cutoff, which breaks the scale invariance of the background. Yes. Rho pi pi or gamma. Yes, it is possible to calculate the form factor, and of course, it will be dominated by the, it will be a sum of the resonances. I can tell you, if I'm not wrong, that the raw meson gives contribution which is something around 15%. I mean, which is something like, it's 15% off of the, so it's 115%. So the other resonances, well, the, there is a sum rule. The pion form factor should be equal to the pion isospin charge, which is 1. Right, so the contribution of rho to the pion factor at zero momentum is 1.15. So the other mesons contribute the other 15%. This is how it works. I don't think so. I was also surprised to find this, but apparently there's no. They can have different size. Rho pi pi, I'm not sure how to define it because I don't know what is the rho. For the gamma, it's a point like rho is, right, gamma I can define, the, so the pion form factor I can define as a matrix element, pi p plus q with momentum j mu times pi of q. So this is a function of q, right. So this is the form factor which I am talking about. Loop corrections in the five-dimensional theory or four-dimensional loop? Five-dimensional. Well, in the case of the five-dimensional theory, because of the, if NC is large, then the coupling of the five-dimensional theory is small, which... Yes, of course. But there are factors of 2 pi squared in the loop integrals. So... No, of course, the value of NC, if you try to estimate the contribution of the loops, is not large enough. So, yes, it is surprising that this model gives such an... Perhaps a correct way of looking at it is saying that we're trying to build an effective theory in a way that the effective theory for the mesons works pretty well, although the coupling of pion to nucleon is of order 14 or so. In this bottom-up approach, we don't really know what this five-dimensional theory is. We're trying to build it. I think it could be a field theory, most likely it will be a string theory. The problem with this field theory is that when we try to represent the operators with spin bigger than 2, we cannot think of a field theory to do that.
Thirds of the two theory, which is just not a
Maybe you should ask this Herbert on Friday, no? But he thought about it. Yes, it is an interesting question. It would be interesting to see, because there is also a tower of mesons. Yes.
Okay, let's break for lunch and resume the truth.